Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Bruno Barron of the Heartland Institute, conservative commentator Marty Garrity, Dave Lundy of Aileron Communications, and John McCarron of DePaul University. Our program tonight, coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, it's beyondthebeltway.com. Well, tonight we're going to be talking about, obviously, politics, national politics, healthcare politics, Obamacare politics, and all of the above, and we'll be taking your telephone calls as we always do. But first of all, I want to begin with one of our card-carrying Democrats, Dave Lundy. Dave, nice to have you with us.
Thanks, Bruce.
Aileron Communications. You are generally here carrying the flag for the Democratic Party and defending the president in all ways. Is it difficult for you to carry the flag tonight, given the president's week and his press conference and sort of the rough week that he had?
It's not difficult at all. Look, any good Democrat is the one who right now are the folks who are most upset about how this rollout has gone. Frankly, the crocodile tears being shed by our Republican friends about, oh, the awful rollout really doesn't bring a lot of concern to me.
So what, is it just 39 Democrats that are upset about this?
No, there's 39 Democrats who have tough races, and they made a smart, a prudent vote from their perspective. No, we're all upset. I mean, we're upset because this was a great opportunity, and the president messed it up something fierce.
Bruno Barron also joins us. Bruno, what is your assessment? Again, are you licking your chops, crocodile tears? Are you cheering the rough week for the president?
Well, I'd be lying if I didn't say there wasn't a little bit of Schadenfreude. But when something goes bad for the United States of America, you don't want it to go bad for the country. And this is just another example. I've been having some back and forth with my Facebook friends who are liberals, and it's not so much like bashing the president and bashing Obamacare, two things of which I've done in the past, I guess. But it's the hubris that I hope that everybody from across the spectrum can step back and say, maybe we should be a little bit more careful about how we take over 1/6 of the economy, and maybe we should have longer term plans and more transitions and longer transitions and a little bit less hubris that, oh, we can just make everything work with this law.
John McCarron also joins us. John is a Democrat. He is a journalist. He acknowledges both, teaches at DePaul University. As a journalist, has there been an overstatement of the president's problems of the last week, or do you think it's been a really bad week for him?
Oh, there's always an overstatement. You know, thousands of planes land safely every day at airports around the world, but we only report on the crashes. So some of that is going on. But I guess, unlike Dave, I'm a little more, I guess, older and wiser now that I look at the White House, and I see a president who's sort of nonchalant, a little bit slack. And it's not just the website or even this telling people they weren't going to lose their insurance. It's going back to the gee, I didn't know we were spying on Angela Merkel kind of things. I just even Ronald Reagan, who I think napped through much of his presidency. You know, I had someone like Jim Baker there to run the government, you know, and I'm wondering, is this president surrounded by spin doctors, or I mean, is there someone running the government?
Marty Garrity, you're the closest thing to a card-carrying conservative tonight. Are you gleeful in hearing the Democratic members of our panel acknowledge that Barack Obama cannot walk on water and has made some big mistakes?
Well, you know, it's hard to find glee in something that I really consider to be very bad for this country and for the people in it that I care about. And so glee is probably the wrong word. I think that it will be bad for Obama and for the Democrats in 2014 and for the next year going forward. I have to give credit, though, to the one person I think who may have been the reason for Obama's about-face here. I would say that when the so-called shutdown occurred, Obama felt he had won by simply refusing to give an inch. And along comes Bill Clinton last Tuesday and said, saying in public, you know, you better give more than an inch. You better give to people what you promised them.
Would you agree with that, Dave?
Not at all. Look, the president had said already, before Bill Clinton spoke, the president gave an interview to Chuck Todd in which he pretty clearly telegraphed that he was going to be walking back on deadlines and things like that. I didn't see anything other than Bill Clinton articulating it a little more clearly to say what the president was already working on. I mean, if you really think that the president came out and made that announcement on Thursday, that he was going to be doing this rollback, and that all happened in 24 hours after Bill Clinton spoke, I would suggest it didn't happen.
Well, speaking about what the president said on Thursday, again, there was a lot of backtracking at that press conference, and one point of that was this quote: "With respect to the pledge I made that if you like your plan, you can keep it, I think, and I've said in interviews, that there is no doubt that the way I put that forward unequivocally ended up not being accurate. It is not because of my intention not to deliver on that commitment and that promise." I mean, is this going to be the pledge that everyone is going to remember? Is this indelibly etched, this broken promise, at least perceived as a broken promise, John?
I think, November 2014 is a long time away in American politics. A lot of things are going to happen between now and then. It sounds a little like what the definition of is, I mean, when you look at it that way. But frankly, I don't think he's engaged to the point that he really perhaps understood that everyone's insurance was going to change as of January 1st.
Go ahead, Marty.
That simply can't be true. The fundamental requirement of Obamacare was that people who now have substandard policies that they may like a lot have to get out of. They have to be taken out of those policies. They have to be forced to take out.
Marty,
so, John, let me finish.
Yeah.
So he can't have not known that the fundamental requirement of his own policy.
Maybe, though, he was talking about the 95% of the people for whom this is going to be true.
But, it's not going to be true for 95%, and he didn't say anything about only 5% of you are going to get screwed. He said, you're all going to be taken care of.
I'm not an expert on Obamacare, but I've been following this relatively closely.
Either.
Right. Well, apparently not. Ouch. Very good point. I wish I'd have said that. But the fascinating thing here is there's two situations. Number one, and I don't know exactly when the Senate amendment came through, but the Republican senators actually gave the Democrats an opportunity. They said, if you pass this amendment to the law, lots of people are going to lose their insurance. And the Democrats voted that down. So the Democrats who voted that down have to bear the responsibility for that vote. And then I believe, if I'm not mistaken, there was a time when Obama was talking to the Republican caucus, and he was told by Republicans in the caucus that this was going to happen, and he ignored them. So the saying that we didn't know this was going to happen, I really think it's a stretch.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. From coast to coast and border to border on America's great talk radio stations and Sirius and XM satellite radio, I'm Bruce Dumont, live from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We will continue our conversation, go to calls in just a moment. But first of all, we wish well and prayers to those within the sound of the flagship station WLS Radio. Central Illinois went through some severe thunderstorms and tornadoes this afternoon, and reported 3 people have been killed. Hundreds really pushed out of their homes because of this horrible circumstance weather-wise within the sound of our voice on WLS Radio. In fact, they stopped the Chicago Bears game for the first time, I think, in NFL history. Today, the Bears ended up winning it. But again, many people within the sound of our voice this evening are going through some really tough times, and our prayers are with you. Hope you get back on track as quickly as possible. Dave Lundy is our Democrat. You wanted to make a point to Marty during the break. He basically had said that he thought the media was letting Barack Obama, for the most part, get away with some of these falsehoods or shuffling of his feet on Obamacare. And you said
I said, clean it up for air. I'll use a Joe Bidenism, the clean version. That's a lot of malarkey, as Joe Biden might say. If you look, the moment the government shutdown in, the media has been savaging Barack. Every single cable channel has been going after the website and the pledge and all of it, and they're just dissecting his presidency, deservedly so. But the notion, and I've seen this from my conservative friends, that, oh, the media is going to give him a free ride, the media is going to give him a pass. They're not giving him any pass, and they shouldn't be giving him a pass.
Dave, I would grant you that they've been tough on him for the last 2 weeks. But even if I grant you since the end of the shutdown, my point is that when Obama made that promise over and over, he was running for re-election. And a media that cared about the truth would have hammered him for telling that lie. But they didn't. They cared about getting him reelected. The journalists were busy keeping Obama safe, and he knew that they'd keep him safe, and he knew that he could get away with lies.
John McCarran.
It's a massive conspiracy, right, Marty?
Yeah, I mean, a vast right-wing conspiracy.
Media conspiracy. I worked 3 decades for the Chicago Tribune, which hasn't endorsed a Republican, or I should say hasn't endorsed a Democrat for president in over 100 years. I think it was Horace Greeley and the guy who did
Except Barack Obama.
Barack
Obama
doesn't count? Well, we're talking about Barack Obama, John.
Most recent history, right. But here's something to think about. I did work for the Tribune for 27 years, and never once did I get the same insurance policy from year to year. It was group health insurance under an annual contract. Every fall there was enrollment pay. I think I'm talking about most insured people in this country. And there's something different every year. It's a new contract. Often the changes were minuscule.
Sometimes they
were significant.
Those changes are the excuse that they use.
I want to come back to, as opposed to getting to the specifics of the law, which again is evolving, but from a political standpoint, if 4 weeks ago or 5 weeks ago we were talking about the Republicans had stubbed their toe badly on the government shutdown.
Right.
And there were real questions as to whether or not there would be any, you know, whether they would be losing seats come 2014. Do you think the events of the last 2 weeks, not only the 39 Democrats that jumped, last week, but, I mean, are things turning around for the Republicans? And do they run the risk of maybe gloating too much and screwing it up again?
Well, as I think most of us would agree that both parties, but the Republicans in particular, can always snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. But I think it's already been said here. There's a long time between now and November 14. There's a lot of mistakes that both sides could make. There's a lot of things people can do to make things better. I think what may happen, and I don't really hold it out very much because I don't see Barack Obama being like Bill Clinton, but this is an opportunity to almost go back to the drawing board and pass a better law. I'm pretty darn conservative. I'd love to see a more conservative healthcare plan, but if it's possible for a rich nation like this to get something that has close to universal coverage that is much better than this kludge of Obamacare, it would be nice to see both parties would look good to the American people and the vast American center if they could actually fix this thing.
Is he ever going to get over the perception now that the administration has been incompetent? I mean, that was the one thing. In post-Katrina, George Bush was never able to get over the competence issue as it related to the administration. Has Barack Obama made that cardinal mistake from his perspective? With the website, the press conference last week, Marty, what do you think?
I think that the incompetence issue will be very tough for him to get over. It is, in that respect, it's his Katrina. But people didn't ever say that anything about Katrina represented dishonesty on the part of George Bush. In this case, you've got people generally agreed. I mean, if you look at the polls, generally agreed that not only has Barack Obama been dishonest, but he's also been incompetent.
But again, they were saying about George Bush that he lied about WMD. So there was the charge of lying, and then there was the charge of incompetence, which, Dave, let me ask you the question. Is this a legitimate issue? I mean, I think you've already acknowledged it. I mean, competence is a legitimate issue. You don't seem to, insofar as the lying, I mean, do you buy the lying? Is it truth-telling? Is it fudging the truth? I mean, what was it that he said over and over and over again?
There's little way to characterize the promise that he made as anything other than unequivocal.
Right.
So I think that whether he meant it for 95% or – I mean, all he had to do is, Marty, as you said, is put a little asterisk on it. And say, for most of you, you know, if you like your plan, you can keep your plan. By making it so unequivocal, he created a trap for himself that he's now in. All of that having been said, not only is there an enormous amount of political time to get to the next election, let alone 2016, but the one thing that the polls have shown pretty consistently is that while the public is frustrated with Barack Obama and they're disappointed with Barack Obama, the only political party they hate more than Democrats is still Republicans.
It's an interesting point, but and I've seen the same polls, and I would put it this way. I would like to see the individual numbers for all of the individual congressmen, all 435 of them, and see which one of them are actually worse than Barack Obama's right now. And there may be some, but I don't think any of them are down to 39%. And yes, he's the president. He can come back from that. We can acknowledge that.
By the way, the bill that passed the other day was Keep Your Health Care Act. That's the Keep Your Health Care Act.
Right.
That's a good vote to be yes on.
Yeah, it is, except for the fact that it also is horrific policy at this point. It's like
it's going to be vetoed by the president. And the
problem
is veto that bill.
Well, it's never going to get to the president.
They're trying to fix the unfixable is one of the problems. But in all seriousness, I think the real indicator, and yes, the Republican Party is still not popular, but they're clearly there's a pox on both parties at this point. But if you really want to see the indicator, look at Kay Hagan in North Carolina. She was 12 points up, cruising to reelection. She's a center left Democrat whose state was happy with her, and now she's dead even, and everybody's salivating to run against her. The real problem for the Democrats at this point is keeping the Senate. And if the Republicans do the right things, or if they appear to do the right things, and the Democrats run into troubles with having to run against good Republican candidates, the Senate is in play now more than it was a month ago.
Let's go to Daniel, Algonquin, Illinois, listening to us on our flagship station WLS. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, this is a man-made disaster, this whole plan. And, by their logic, because this plan is substandard, not just the website, but the whole law is substandard. So why don't we, repeal the law and replace it with something better?
Well, it's easy to say it's a disaster, but if you have a child who's still living at home at age 24, or if you know or love someone who had a pre-existing condition and couldn't get health insurance at anything near an affordable price, maybe you don't think it's such a disaster.
Or if you had a condition with a lifetime and a policy with a lifetime cap, like a colleague of mine in my office does. I mean, the fact is, you cannot say Obamacare has been an unmitigated disaster as a whole, because there have been a lot of things that have been part of this law, including the ones that we're talking about, that have had an enormous impact on real people's lives. You know, with that awful, awful website, when you go to apply and you go to set up your account, you don't answer health questions. And I don't know about you guys, but I've applied for individual health insurance in the past, and I got to answer 143 different health questions. And God forbid I make a slight mistake, they can then claim it's a pre-existing condition and not cover me. That is no longer the case.
Yeah, and as a result, everyone who has made prudential decisions about what kind of insurance coverage that they want to carry for their own families or for themselves, they are going to be paying the price that comes with your freedom to join this take one of these policies and be very, very expensive for those policies, because everybody in the country is going to have to pay that bill that you, as somebody who might have had some pre-existing condition, won't have to pay.
I agree with Marty. I agree with you, Marty. I'll put it in writing. I agree with you. And a big problem here is that wasn't made explicit from the get-go, and it should have been.
Well, and that's a function of how poor the quality of our politicians is. The Republicans are the same way. No one wants to tell the American people the truth. If you want universal coverage, everyone's going to have to pay more. If you want no pre-existing conditions and no underwriting, everyone's going to have to pay more. If you want Viagra and birth control pills covered, everyone's going to have to pay more. And instead, you have one party that says tort reform and state lines is going to solve everything, and then you have another party that says we're going to give everybody everything they want and it's not going to cost more.
Well, and it's not actually true that everybody's going to be paying more. I mean, I've already seen this example with multiple people who are going to pay significantly less than they did
They'll
before.
Go to Medicaid. Not
going to Medicaid. I'm talking about people who were in the individual market who are now moving into the exchanges, and what they're finding, at least the folks that I've been talking to, is that they have a much better policy but they're not single males at 28 years old.
Are they? But that's because of the subsidy. They're getting less. They're paying less because of the subsidy.
Some people are subsidized, and yes, that's true.
When we come back, 1-800-723-8229, we will take more calls and continue with our conversation from coast to coast and border to border, live every Sunday night. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back in Chicago, thank you very much for joining us. We now introduce our guests, or we let them introduce themselves, and we begin with one of our Democrats, and that is David Lundy.
Thank you, Bruce. I run a communications and public affairs strategy firm called Aileron Communications. We work mostly with clean energy as well as some private equity and technology companies. I have two kids, Max and Eli, who are probably listening now as they're getting ready for bed.
Test them on what you say when on the show? Do you give them a little test?
I have the smartest political kids I've ever met.
I can imagine.
It's
can
very
imagine.
Exciting to listen
to.
So
the other side of the desk, we have Bruno Behrend.
Executive Director of American Transparency. It's a new nonprofit focusing on transparency. I have so many different titles. I have to figure out which wonk title I have.
And the Heartland Institute.
And the Heartland Institute, where I am the Senior Fellow on Education Issues for Public Education and Education Reform.
John McCarron.
Yeah, Bruce, thank you. I'm 27 years at the Chicago Tribune, as I mentioned. Started off as a reporter, as we all do, chasing cops and fires and whatnot. I became eventually the newspaper's urban affairs writer for more than a decade. I eventually was financial editor, went on the editorial board, where I wrote a lot of health insurance editorials because Hillary Care was in the news back then. I made a millennial decision in 2000 to move on. I have taught as an adjunct professor at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern and now at the DePaul School of Communications.
Marty Gertie.
I've been a commercial real estate broker for 40 years, primarily representing tenants looking for office space. I'm pretty much retired now, but I still have a few people that I'm doing some things with. I have six kids and nine grandchildren. And a delightful wife, and we've recently moved from Evanston to Skokie.
Very good. And those are suburbs of Chicago for those listening around the country. By the way, before we go back to calls, let me remind you that next Friday, November 22nd, is the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And at 12:30 in the afternoon at the Museum of Broadcast Communications, we are going to begin playing. That's exactly when the bulletin came in. Actually, it came in about 12:34. The assassination coverage of NBC will play it throughout the day into the early evening hours. If you want to come down, admission to the museum next Friday is free. For those people that want to come down and see it, we are at 360 North State Street in Chicago. Again, the Museum of Broadcast Communications. If you are of my generation and remember exactly where you were and want to relive that memorable moment in American history, you can do so. And if you're younger and you've heard your parents or grandparents talk about it, you can experience it for yourself. Not only the evolving history, but also the very rudimentary elements of American journalism at that particular time, the slowness with which they were reacting to so much news. But again, a very dramatic moment, 50 years literally to the moment, starting next Friday at 12:34 at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Let's go to calls. Let's go to Mike listening to us on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead.
How you doing, gentlemen?
Okay.
I've been listening to this Obamacare thing for quite a while, and I find it just ironic that this, what he said was completely wrong. There's no doubt about it. Was it a malicious lie? I don't think so. I think he really meant that. Okay?
Okay.
But the problem is that this president has been held to such a different standard than past presidents, because his lie didn't get 5,000 soldiers killed. because the Iraq war was completely unnecessary by his means, by his reasoning.
Mike, there is no one, Mike, there is no one who seriously thinks that the entire world knew, or doesn't think, rather, that the entire world knew that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. They were wrong, but
really?
Everybody,
well, here, I have a name
Mike,
for you.
Mike, 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 every intelligence agency in the world knew that he had WMDs. They were wrong, but they knew it. And so while it may have been a giant mistake, it was not a lie. Anywhere.
Yes, it was.
Mike, thank you very much. You've made your point. Let's move on to John in Naperville. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi there. You know, I want to know, when are people going to wake up that we have a know-nothing president? He didn't know about Fast and Furious. He didn't know about the IRS. He didn't know about NSA. He didn't know about Benghazi. He didn't know about the website. Then he goes out there and lies. He lies like a rug. But he knew about Gates over in Boston. He knew about Trayvon Martin in Florida. And yet these mopes keep holding him up and covering him up and talking about how he's celestial. Brightest guy in the room. What room is he in?
Good point. And I want to come back to John, because John alluded to that in his first answer tonight, is that, you know, he didn't come across very impressive at the press conference. He was apologizing all over the place. Did he look, John, in your view, did he look weak by doing that? Did he look in that he was in over his head? Or did he look like a guy who was just going to acknowledge that the buck stopped with him and mistakes were made and he made the mistakes and he apologized for it because he believes that the American people are fair and honest and they're going to say, well, he's trying and he's doing the best he can.
Bruce, do I get a none of the above?
Sure, you know, absolutely.
I hang out with guys who knew Barack Obama even before he was a state senator, or certainly right before he was a U.S. senator. And they'll tell you that he's a laid-back kind of guy. He is not a super detail kind of guy. He is not a hands-on manager kind of guy.
Is he a super smart guy?
He's a policy guy. He is you betcha. Yeah, he's a very smart guy, but not in a detail. That's why he needs a Jim Baker kind of person, I think, to actually manage the White House. And I for instance, the Merkel thing, I don't know if you probably don't want to get into those weeds, but, I mean, as soon as that guy goes over the hill to Russia, a good manager is going to call in his chief of staff and say, what do I need to know about what this guy's going to tell the, you know, the Manchester Guardian?
Right.
But it was apparent when he didn't know about the Merkel spying thing that he didn't go through that process. And that's, that's Barack Obama. I mean, I think he's very extremely well-intended, but I think he's a policy guy.
And Dave Lundy, you want to follow up on that, and then I have a political question for you. Dave Lundy.
Yeah, look, I'm one of those guys who knew Barack back when he was in Springfield.
So did I.
Yeah, exactly.
He on the show a number of times.
Barack was and is an extremely smart guy. He's a very intelligent guy. He's
honest.
Professor Barack. Generally speaking, completely honest.
Great family man.
Great family man.
White Sox
fan. And White Sox fan. I don't hold that against him.
Keen and well-spoken, too.
But
articulate. Yes.
Very nice. Thank you, Joe Biden, for those who missed that reference. But here's the thing. I've been wondering, where is the David Gergen of this administration?
Or the David Axelrod of this administration?
Well, no. I actually think – well, I don't want to get
haven't some of his problems happened since David came back to Chicago?
Sure, but it's classic second-term problems. I mean, okay. I think that the issue, though, is an operational issue, and that was not what Axe was focused on. It's an operational issue, and you look back at Bill Clinton, and when Bill Clinton got into his big problems and realized that he had really messed up in those first couple of years. Yes, he brought in Dick Morris on the political side, but he brought in David Gergen to say, hey, this is a guy who's been there, done that, knows how this town should operate, and he is going to be a very important senior advisor, and he was. Who is the David Gergen of this administration? We're stuck still, with all due respect, with Valerie Jarrett advising the president, who is not doing him any service.
But what you hear about him is that he won't accept anybody like a David Gergen. If you take your life in your hands, if you go into his office and say, "Mr. President, you're wrong. You've got to change what you're
doing." Oh, that's nonsense. Well, that's not. Look at who he surrounded himself with. He brought Hillary Clinton, his chief rival, into the cabinet. He brought very heavyweight people. That is not true, and it's not my experience, and it's not the experience of people I know who know him and work with him closely. Well, that having been said, we're missing something here.
What was Bill Daley brought in for, in your view?
I think Bill Daley was brought in for that, but I think that was a – I said at the time it was a mistake. I didn't think Bill Daley had that kind of experience or gravitas. And since he recently has acknowledged that, since he found running a campaign for governor of Illinois so overwhelming that he couldn't handle that. So, yeah, we'll just leave that alone.
Bruno.
I was going to use Bill Daley as an example. I mean, he was supposed to come in and kind of fit that mold. But, we're hearing a nice, wonderful partisan side for everybody who's talking about how smart Barack Obama is. If he was as smart as everybody says he was, and I'm not discounting the fact that he's clearly got a few brain cells to rub together, but if he was really that smart, I don't think he'd be having these problems in his administration. I know that
you
there's
can
a,
be smart. You can oh, be smart a, and incompetent. You'd be both.
Well,
Jimmy Carter was very smart. Jimmy Carter was very smart.
Well,
but he wasn't a manager, and he was sort of in. Yeah, he was
you ever notice
it
a lot? And this goes not so much as media bias as just the way everything is reported. Liberals are always supposed to be super smart, and conservatives are always supposed to be these morons who, you know, are actually dumb enough to believe in God or something.
Sarah
like that.
Sarah Palin.
And when they get into office, the so-called dumb conservatives, like we just heard one of those things here today, that Ronald Reagan supposedly slept through his administration. Somehow George Bush, with almost no public backing, with polls in the high 30s or low 40s, managed to get everything he needed to get done relative to the Iraq War with a Democratic Congress and very, very low approval ratings. Conservatives are just better managers. And here's why. I'll bring it down to this point. Conservatives are actually judged by what they do or don't get done or how they get it done, and liberals are judged by their intentions. So as long as they wanted everything to work out great, they get an A+.
What about that? Those are strong words.
I know. Roosevelt had Harry Hopkins. I think there's a there's some truth to what you're saying in that the presidency now has become – a constant campaign where you're out there stumping, or you're greeting the Blackhawks hockey team and congratulating them for winning the Stanley. You're doing all these things. You need somebody who's back in the office, who's dotting the I's and crossing the T's. And I think good presidents get that. And I agree with Dave that I'm not sure we've got one there now.
All right. Well, that is one of our Democrats talking tonight, 1-800-723-8229. When we come back, we will continue our conversation and your calls, 1-800-723-8229. I'm Bruce Dumont, live from Chicago every Sunday night. Nice to have you with us. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us this evening. We have spoken over the last couple of weeks about the Republican presidential field for 2016, talking a little bit about what the Democrats may be up to. But another story has emerged over the last couple of weeks, and I want to get our Democrats to sort of respond to it, and that is the possibility that Elizabeth Warren may be giving some serious conversation and discussions about entering the race for the Democratic nomination. You think that's a serious flotation of a rumor or not?
No,
you don't.
No, I don't. I absolutely don't. She's already endorsed Hillary Clinton. I think that there is the left wing of the Democratic Party has never been comfortable with Hillary Clinton. They were never comfortable with Bill Clinton. So it doesn't surprise me that there's some energy kind of gravitating around Elizabeth Warren. Kristen Gillibrand was on one of the Sunday talk shows today, was asked about, because her face was put on the National Journal cover as a possible presidential candidate. And she laughed.
Yeah.
And she said, I've endorsed Hillary. And frankly, I think Elizabeth Warren is going to do the same. She may keep it alive for her own fundraising or other reasons, but it's not a real threat.
John McCarron, do you think there's any serious challenge to Hillary Clinton if she wants the nomination?
Oh, well, nomination. Sure. You know, we have a vice president out there. I'm not sure he's committed one way or the other to whether he.
What would he do? You, in your view, would he put a strong? Would he put up a strong fight?
Well, that wasn't your question.
Well, it is now. Change my question. It's not a follow-up.
No, I think it's. I think she's the person to beat. Pretty strongly, but
everyone knows at this table. Everyone knows at this table that she can be beaten.
Yeah, one but that's a different Hillary Clinton.
One would hope.
I would love to see her.
What is different about Hillary Clinton?
She's
now?
A woman. Because I mean, I think a lot of
she was
a lot
woman,
of guys.
She was a woman 7 years ago too.
I was going to say that hasn't changed. No, I think
yeah.
she's still wearing the same pantsuits.
You just made my point. I think at the top of the ticket in a general election, I think that would be a real the moment of truth for a lot of men in this country.
But I think that Hillary Clinton did herself a world of good by getting out of politics and moving over to the State Department. Other than the continued witch hunt on Benghazi, Hillary Clinton is generally viewed by moderates and liberals and Republicans and Democrats as a very solid Secretary of State.
What was the greatest thing she did as Secretary of State?
What did she ever do as Secretary of State?
That's what I just asked.
I'm not telling you that I think that I can articulate one single thing. I think people thought she ran the State Department well. She presented the United States well. She did a very good job of working with allies.
China has gone in the toilet since Barack Obama became president. It was already sort of toilet bound. Eastern Europe is lost. I mean, basically Hillary Clinton and her foreign policy people went in and with Barack Obama's assent, basically surrendered to the Russians. They gave up all of our missiles in Eastern Europe. Western Europe, supposedly the Western Europeans were going to love us because we had this clever, smart, articulate, clean guy as president. They think we're nuts.
They think we're nuts because we're bugging Angela Merkel and all their cell phones.
The Arab world was supposed to be our friends, and he went in and he went to Egypt and he said, "Hey, we're going to love you guys and we're going to take care of you. Don't worry." And they think he's an idiot. I mean, what part of the world are we in better shape now in because of Hillary Clinton's tenure in the State Department?
Well,
Name one.
Well, first of all, I don't
let him finish. Let him finish.
Brazil, Argentina, they're all gone.
Let him finish.
You have just thrown out a laundry list. Mm-hmm. Of countries, I don't agree with you about pretty much most of them. The notion that Barack sold out Eastern Europe because we weren't going to have because of the treaty with the Russians and the missiles. I'm sorry, the Cold War. We're not going to have a nuclear war with the Soviet Union.
Right.
They're gone. So it was an idiotic policy, and they made a prudent decision. Look, it was George W. Bush who said, "I looked into Putin's eyes and I saw a great humanitarian there."
Somebody I could deal with.
Whatever it was.
But I think what's from a political standpoint here. I think and you made the point about that she's been a great Secretary of State and respected. I just don't think that Republicans and I don't even hopefully not even some members of the media are going to next year if she decides to run. I don't think they're just going to accept as gospel that she was the inevitable candidate for president 7 years ago or 6 years ago and she didn't make it. She ran a horrible campaign. One of the biggest fumbles in political history was hers, orchestrated by her, again, also brilliant husband, Bill Clinton. They blew it. They blew something that was absolutely on a silver platter. And I don't think that the Democrats now can just start out with, "Oh, well, Hillary Clinton, she was a great Secretary of State." And when I asked you what made her a great Secretary of State, you weren't quite sure. Our Republican came up with five or six things or seven things that you disagreed with. But I don't know. I mean, because to the general public, the thing that they will most remember her by, and certainly they will if she's the candidate for President of the United States, is the one thing that happened on her watch where four Americans got killed. And there's a question about her competence in that matter. That does matter, and it certainly raises the question as to whether or not she was a great hands-on Secretary of State who, when it came time to testify, you know, she had to go to the hospital.
First of all, I think a great American political party with a history like the Democratic Party deserves somebody better representing it than someone as incompetent and dishonest as Hillary Clinton. When she was running against Barack Obama, her campaign was caught, and I can't even remember every detail, but I was fired upon, I did this. Her campaign was a litany of lies. Every party, whether it's the Republican or the Democratic Party, or hopefully America will get another party sometime soon, But every American deserves somebody who's better than the "it's my turn" mentality, and then factor on top of that the filthy identity politics of, oh, we had a black president, now we have to have a woman president. It's absurd. This country deserves better leadership than these people.
We're out of time. Bruno Barron and Marty Garrity, they have been on the right side of our table this evening. On the left side, we have had John McKernan. We've had David Lundy. They will all be back for a second hour if you're listening to this broadcast on radio. And if you're watching us on television, well, we hope you like the picture, and we will see you next week. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Tonight, providing commentary by Bruno Barron of the Heartland Institute, conservative commentator Marty Garrity, David Lundy of Aileron Communications, and John McKernan of DePaul University. Our phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to give us an email, a call, or email a letter, you can go to beyondthebeltway.com and also beyondthebeltwaymuseum.tv. In this hour of our program, we're going to spend the next hour talking about one of the pivotal moments in recent American history, and recent being 50 years ago, because we are coming up on Friday of this week, the 22nd. It will be the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. Much changed in America on that day. There have already been numerous documentaries that have been run on the subject and also a great deal written on it. And instead of doing a broadcast after the fact, we thought we would leapfrog it a little bit and do it tonight. So tonight we're going to be talking about the Kennedy assassination, the impact that it had on society. And if you are a person of my generation, you will remember exactly where you were on that day, which was also a Friday, November 22nd, about 12:34 Central Time in the afternoon, when that bulletin broke from Dallas, Texas. And if you are a younger listener to this program, you've heard your parents and grandparents talk about it. And I'm sure you perhaps have questions and observations about it as well. So I'm going to begin with John McKernan, who for 27 years was a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. John, I want to get to your personal story in just a moment. But again, as you look at that day, what in your view changed that day in American history?
I think a sense of security, and that we sort of knew what was going to happen tomorrow and the day after. I think for a lot of baby boomers, you know, we were born after the war had been won, so we weren't exposed to that chaos and violence. And we came up, you know, grew up in this bubble called the 1950s of relative affluence and the Eisenhower years and whatnot. It just seems like that just cut like a knife across our consciousness and made us realize that the future was not at all guaranteed for anyone.
Marty Garrity, you are Irish Catholic. Our Irish Catholic came from an Irish Catholic Democratic family. I want to get to the personal side of that day for you and your family. But again, looking at the bigger, broader issue, what in your view happened on that day?
Yeah, I think that we lost a sense that I had at that time, and many did, that when Kennedy said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country," a lot of us, and I was a freshman in college at the time, a lot of us said, "That particular dream is cut short here." He represented that, and he's no longer there. He was somebody that people like me really looked up to, and frankly, in much the same way that a lot of people today, young people today, think of Barack Obama, just a superstar guy, and we lost him, and it was a very sad event, and we lost I agree with John. We lost a certain amount of innocence then, too.
Bruno Barron joins us. Bruno is pretty much of a libertarian. You were not alive.
No, I was.
How old were you?
I was three.
So you don't remember it?
I was sitting around at home, and all of a sudden my mom started. I mean, this is one of my earlier memories. I was sitting around at home, and doing what three-year-olds do, you know, playing or doing something. And all of a sudden, my mom, I still remember the radio, too, the old Zenith with the dial. You know, mm-hmm. I think there's one of them in your studio here.
Yeah.
And she just started screaming and going, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh. And I was like a little kid. I was started being scared. So I didn't really have, you know, sense all the same implications that the other two gentlemen here did because I was only three. But I did get a sense that something went wrong. From my perspective, having followed politics all my life and being raised in a very political family, I guess the one thing I would say about it, and this is not to take away anything of the impact and what it meant, but I think the amazing thing about America, whether it's William McKinley or Abraham Lincoln or John F. Kennedy, the country is so solid and it is built on such strong principles that it endures.
Dave Lundy, you were not born yet.
I was not, and I appreciate this group reminding me that I am under 50, and that's not old. So thank you for that. But look, there's no doubt that this had such a profound impact on our politics, on the view of the man as a president. You wonder, and as a student of politics, I've often thought about, well, what would it have been like had Kennedy lived and had to deal with Vietnam? You know, would there be reverence? Would, you know, some of the stories that obviously we now know about his womanizing and a lot and the drug use because of his medical condition,
Addison's disease.
You know, how would that have impacted, you know, the way that our history played out?
I'd like to just pick up on one part of that, and that is the you know, what would have happened in Vietnam. Would he have made the same mistakes, I think, that Lyndon Johnson made? I certainly don't think that the advancement of civil rights would have been as fast as it was under Lyndon Johnson, because John Kennedy did not have great legislative accomplishments in the 2 years he was president. All of those things happened in the Great Society, which Lyndon Johnson was able to do, given his status as majority leader. And that's one of the reasons why he was put on the ticket, in addition to carrying Texas. But I'm not so sure that there would have been the political success, the significant changes in civil rights, as well as the escalation of the Vietnam War, had John Kennedy lived.
No, Lyndon Johnson had a lot of things to prove, and he wanted to go out there and show that there was life after Kennedy. And he obviously had the Congress in the palm of his hand, worked it hard, worked it well, got a lot of things done. Jack Kennedy, Vietnam, I don't know. You know, Maxwell Taylor was his main military advisor, and he was relatively hawkish, sort of bought into, you know, we could play the guerrilla game in the Third World. But Kennedy did have this sort of native, I mean, not native, but he was, you know, PT-109. He was a junior officer in the Navy, and as was I much, much later. And he realized that a lot of people in middle management in the Navy don't really know what they're doing, or they're a little overly aggressive and whatnot. So he got led down the path at the Bay of Pigs. I think that was lesson number one. And when the standoff with Castro over the, and Khrushchev came along, he was very untrusting of, I mean, he wasn't going to leave it to the admirals to decide who was going to start World War III. So I don't know, going into Vietnam, I don't know. I think there's a lot of the conventional wisdom is that never would have happened the way it did if Kennedy were alive. I'm not so sure.
Is he, in your view, if he was a Democrat alive today, where would he stand in the current Democratic Party, in your view, Marty?
Oh, I don't think he would be anywhere. He wouldn't even be considered for president or whatever. He would be way too far to the right. He'd probably be in the left wing of the Republican Party rather than the right wing of the Democratic Party.
You agree with that?
No, I don't. Look, the people are functions of their time. And I think that for his time, he was very much in the middle of the Democratic Party. And I think that if he were alive today, I couldn't imagine him feeling comfortable in the Republican Party based upon so many of the things that he stood for.
We're going to pause. 1-800-723-8290. Your reaction to the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. Do we make too much of it? Or if you were of my generation, your reaction and answer to the same question. How did politics change on November 22nd, 1963? Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We're talking about the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, the 50th anniversary coming up this Friday. We're talking about this significance and how American politics that changed. And obviously we talked about sort of the loss of innocence that transpired, but also the transition in U.S. Policies in some areas, primarily in Vietnam and also in the civil rights movement. Because, you know, we're talking about, you know, whether or not John Kennedy would be in the conservative wing of the Democratic Party. I agree with you, Dave. I don't think he'd be in the Republican Party. He wouldn't be a liberal Republican. He would be maybe a, you know, conservative Democrat, or certainly a Scoop Jackson Democrat, who was also a major political figure of that same period when John Kennedy was in the United States Senate. But again, when you look at the loss of innocence, the one thing that I remember as hearing about the assassination, this was several weeks after the assassination, reading stories about when that news broke that there were school children in several places around the country that cheered when they heard the news that President Kennedy had been killed. And it shocked me then. I was, you know, it was 50 years ago, so that was a long time ago. It shocked me when I read it then, but it doesn't shock me today because of the attitude that there are many children who probably felt the same way about George W. Bush. There are many children in America today, or parents that encourage them to think about the same way about Barack Obama today. There is a level of hatred for the President of the United States based on his politics. And so that was something that shocked me then, and it shocks me now. And yet the general impressions that people remember of that time was because of the television and the young family, you know, obviously, you know, the bloodstained dress of Jackie and John saluting the casket when it walked by. I mean, he was a younger president. He was a vital president. He was a family man president with a young daughter and a young son. So he had the empathy of the people, even those who did not support him. I mean, it was a very, very small element of society then that would have cheered and would have been happy with the transition. Marty, I mentioned you came from a Democratic family, and you've said on this program when you made that transition, but being an Irish Catholic, how important was John Kennedy to your parents?
I think he was very important. He was a key guy in their lives. They considered him an Irish Catholic, one of their own, and his election meant for my folks that someday I or one of my kids might be able to run for president, because we had a Catholic president, the first Catholic president, and it was a big, big event in Catholic families all over the country.
John, as a journalist, we are also approaching the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy conspiracy theorists. And as a journalist, I'm wondering whether you have looked at that story with a journalistic eye, and has your opinion changed at all since you became a young reporter, and have you followed this story and certainly the explosion and the fact that in society today the vast majority of people do not believe the Warren Commission. And yet for a large portion, almost 75-80% of the American people, when the Warren Commission was reported, they did buy it and they did believe it.
Yeah, well, there were a lot of loose ends, and I think to some extent there still are. I'm a single shooter, double bullet guy, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I, as a journalist, one tends to be skeptical. But the first rule of journalists is don't discount the obvious. So if there's going to be a commission and it's led by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, you've got to say they're probably going to come up with the right answer. But when you think about, I mean, a single shooter, sort of a ne'er-do-well guy with a Hungarian rifle, knows exactly where to be in the top floor of this book depository, and this gets off two extremely accurate shots. I mean, and also what was going on at the time internationally. I mean, we've learned since, haven't we, that the Kennedy administration wouldn't have minded if someone assassinated Fidel Castro. He also, you know, Bobby, his brother, who was what the
Attorney General,
Attorney General of the United States, was leaning on organized crime in a big way.
To do a hit.
Potential motives were out there. So the idea you had this sort of ne'er-do-well goofball who pulls off the perfect assassination. And yeah, there were doubts out there.
With everything that has been said, again, after there was a period of time when obviously there was a reverence, there was keep the flame alive. But again, as has been alluded before, I mean, the stories, the downside, the ugly, the darker side of John Kennedy, the womanizing, the flirtations with organized crime through the Attorney General, the relationship with Marilyn Monroe. I mean, there was some really salacious things that the journalists of those days weren't reporting. Now, they ultimately did. It generally came out in books that were written. But, I mean, if we had the media that we had today, would the media of today, how differently would they have treated John Kennedy during the time he was alive? Because these stories were circulating about him, but the journalists of the day didn't write about it.
I don't think John Kennedy would have been elected president. If we had the media of today, which often focuses on the ridiculous, you know, the little things. We can talk about just the womanizing stuff.
Yeah,
I mean,
is infidelity a little thing? Is infidelity a little thing to you?
No, well, it's not a little thing. I don't think it's necessarily a disqualifying factor. I mean, I wouldn't have wanted to say, well, no Bill Clinton, no Franklin Roosevelt, no Dwight Eisenhower. But there's a difference between having a relationship and having sex with everything that moves, which seemed to be what John Kennedy did in those days. It's stunning what he did.
But Bill Clinton was doing the same thing. I mean, Bill Clinton and Bill Clinton lied under oath about it, and he was impeached by the House. And when the impeachment reached the Senate, Ken Starr was the guy who was pushing it. And today, Ken Starr is the villain of that story, and Bill Clinton is the innocent hero.
How would the media of today deal with that aspect of it?
I think Dave is probably right but I don't necessarily know that it's a bad thing. If you were to ask a conservative, would he trade three lockdown networks and four or five different radio company and outlets with today's blogosphere and all the different kinds of media that there is, I wouldn't trade the 1960s media for today's media any day of the year. And I don't care about the liberals and the conservatives in it. It's just a better, more open media, and it's more competitive. So I'm for that.
You certainly would not have had the experience of Time Magazine, or Life Magazine, rather,
right?
Buying the Zapruder film and extracting six frames from the Zapruder film and presenting it as fact in Life Magazine, which was one of the top circulation magazines, as that was fact, because you took out the significant six frames that would indicate to many people, because of the trajectory of his head, that maybe he was not shot from the rear.
Well, and I've seen enough of the details of some of the evidence to indicate that, there's more and more people coming out to saying, no, this was just a single shooter. I think anybody who has a conspiracy with all the different things that are going on with that time, anybody who has a reasonably plausible conspiracy theory, it can be forgiven for thinking that maybe it wasn't so cut and dried. But going back to the whole womanizing thing and all the other stuff, I mean, again, he was based on everything I read and hear and films that I've seen, he was a very dynamic, impactful president. He may not have won re-election. He was going to Texas to campaign because he was doing very poorly in the polls. So we don't even know how that would have turned out. As far as one of the things that I always thought about from the whole womanizing thing, maybe it doesn't matter anymore. Maybe Bill Clinton has changed all that. But at the end of the day, you can be blackmailed for that kind of stuff by all kinds of people. Whether they just want some inside deals or whether they want to get some kind of secrets or something like that. So these are all the stuff that goes on. They're not small things. These are presidents we're electing.
When the thread of the Kennedy administration, when they started to pull the thread, and the thread led to Bobby Kennedy and some of the things that Robert Kennedy was involved in as the Attorney General, although he is remembered by many liberals mm-hmm. for what he did with civil rights, mm-hmm. which was tremendous, and it made a tremendous contribution to the country. Again, I think with Lyndon Johnson's strong hand behind it, which is why it became successful.
And Republican votes.
And Republican votes.
Republican majorities.
That is correct.
Not Democratic majorities.
That is exactly correct. But you also had a situation where it involved the role of the CIA. And when I look at the Warren Commission, and I question this when the commission was put together, and I'm still stymied by it now, stupefied by it, I guess, is to look at the people who are on the commission. You said, John, you know, well, you get the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And again, in 1964, the Supreme Court justice was held in high esteem, as were most elected officials, national officials. I think one of the things that happened with the Kennedy assassination and the Warren Commission that came after it is I think people began to question the alleged authority blue ribbon committees that were appointed to look into things. Because when you look at the makeup of the Warren Commission, you had some people that had an axe to grind. They had some vested interests. And again, they were somewhat questionable. And we can get into some of the specifics of that when we come back. But again, to me, it was the Warren Commission is the beginning of the public's mistrust of authority and authority figures. And I think many Americans today think the Warren Commission was a bill of goods sold to the American people, orchestrated by people that didn't even read the report. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Joining us around the table this evening, we have David Lundy. He is the president of Aileron Communications. John McCarron joins us. He is an adjunct professor of journalism at DePaul University. Bruno Barron of the Heartland Institute joins us, and Marty Garrity, conservative commentator. They are all around the table tonight. We are talking about the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. That anniversary is this coming Friday. And again, if you are within the sound of my voice in the city of Chicago, again at 12:30 in the afternoon, the Museum of Broadcast Communications at 360 North State is going to be open free to the public all day that day. And we will be showing the NBC coverage of the Kennedy assassination in real time. And again, one of the things that I find interesting, having watched it a long time ago, we did a similar thing on the 25th anniversary, is how relatively soon, it's within 3 hours of the coverage, that Lee Harvey Oswald is identified as the shooter. It happens rather quickly, and also what happens rather quickly is the speed with which they have B-roll, of which is a video, film, it's a TV term. It's film of him passing out literature, pro-Castro literature in New Orleans, which I always found curious because so much of the so much of the connection, at least to Lee Harvey Oswald, went through New Orleans. We've been talking about the Kennedy assassination, and also talked about the Warren Commission and the reports. I mean, one of the things that I find interesting about the makeup of the Warren Commission, you have the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, you had the Minority Leader, you had Gerald Ford was on that committee, who acknowledged that he never read the Warren Commission, even though he signed it. You had Alan Dulles, who was the former head of the CIA. Alan Dulles was the man who was responsible for the Bay of Pigs invasion. He was fired by President Kennedy, and he ends up on the Warren Commission investigating his assassination. Curious. Hale Boggs was one of the leading members of Congress, Democrat from Louisiana. His daughter is a television commentator. And the surprising thing about that is so many of the leads insofar as the organized crime connection to a possible involvement in that assassination go back to New Orleans. And New Orleans was then a very corrupt city. Organized crime had a very significant stronghold in that city. And one of the longest serving congressmen from that city was Hale Boggs, who ends up on the committee investigating the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. To me, these are curious things, and you've heard me say on this program many times, the one thing I think we need more in government is people who are not Republicans, Democrats, liberals, or conservatives, but who are absolutely obsessed with getting the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, as opposed to a blue ribbon committee that gets together, that they're so busy, they got too many things. I mean, you know, Gerald Ford was the minority leader of the House at the time. How much time does he have to really delve into the intricacies of a serious investigation? So I have always been a suspect of the Warren Commission. I don't have a complete answer, nor anyone does. But, Marty, I want to get everyone's sort of reaction as to, you know, where you are on who did it, and does it really matter 50 years after the fact?
Actually, in the immortal words of Hillary Clinton, what difference does it make? You know, if there were somebody out there today alive whom we could prosecute and send to jail for doing something bad, well, maybe so. But 50 years later, whether Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone or not, I'm uninterested in that. 40 years ago, I might have been, today it doesn't really matter whether the CIA was involved or whether the mafia was involved. All those people who were involved, if they were at all, are dead.
And did it ever bother you? And then I want to get to Bruno. Did it bother you that authority figures at that time, 50 years ago, said there's evidence in this case that we are going to seal from the American people for 87 years? We got 37 more years to wait to find out the evidence that sit in somewhere in the National Archives about the real truth about the Kennedy assassination. Does it bother you, Bruno?
Well, of course it bothers me. I think if I'm not mistaken, isn't Boggs also one of the names that's involved in like one of the biggest lobbying firms in Washington, D.C.? And I'll bet is a relative. Oh. The biggest problem confronting the United States of America today is not the socialism or the crazy Tea Party people. The biggest problem confronting the United States of America today is that we have institutionalized and metastasized an unbelievable amount of corruption to the point that it's actually legal. And what people get away with and what they do is obscene. And I would go so far, and look at what's going on with Illinois right now. The entire state is a function of the bond dealers that are bankrupting the state. So to bring it back to Kennedy just really quickly, I want to know what happened because I want to know who was doing what. If it was just one shooter, that's fine with me. It makes perfect sense. And but if the mob was involved because they wanted Cuba back and they wanted to figure out some way to do something, I don't think it was the Soviets. The Soviets probably figured they could handle Kennedy. Why would they want to shoot him? So I don't know the answer to all this stuff.
Might have.
But well, he may have, but
revenge.
Absolutely, I want to know. And I want to see somebody have that exactly what you talked about. If we don't root out the corruption in both parties and the spending and everything that goes on in this country, we're toast.
Your reaction, John?
It is possible.
Do you believe the Warren Commission?
It is possible that these were a group of wise men who recognized the truth as something the American people couldn't handle.
I think you're right, but boy, you know, that just
the wise men.
I said it was possible.
It's the wise men we can't handle.
No, but
they're not wise.
I think you're right. It's the same mentality that went in to the decision in Life magazine. We're going to take out the six pictures because they will be offensive to the Kennedy family because they're gruesome. They're gruesome pictures. And we have seen gruesome pictures. We've seen gruesome pictures of war. I'm not so sure as a young man, my stomach would have been turned by it. But when a news organization, the top news organization in the country at that time, one of the strongest in the world, when they extract six frames of a picture, they're not giving me the complete picture, no pun intended, of what might have happened in Dallas, Texas. And that bothers me. That means to me there is conspiracy. There is a conspiracy at that particular time that the American people were not grown up enough to accept all of the ramifications where this story might have led. And it might have led. We learned, by the way, we learned about 5 years later of all of the involvement of the Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Attorney General's office and all that was going on to destabilize Cuba and to try to assassinate Fidel Castro, and that they literally were making deals with organized crime to knock off Fidel Castro when the president of the United States was sleeping with a girlfriend of Sam Giancana, who was the leader of organized crime in America. Come on. There's got to be, I mean, you've got to ask questions about that connectivity. Where do you come down on the Warren Commission and the conspiracies in general, David?
I actually will take this rare moment of agreement with Marty. I tend to think conspiracy theories are overwhelmingly bunk. And I think that if you had a conspiracy that was as vast as this one was, I'm sure we all remember the movie JFK with Kevin Costner. That was the most absurd, ridiculous Oliver Stone fantasy, because the notion that you're going to be able to keep a conspiracy that had to involve hundreds and probably thousands of people and keep that under wraps for decades in this country
but you haven't kept it under wraps. I mean the fact that we've gone from 70% belief in the Warren Commission to 70% or more disbelieving the Warren Commission means that people are buying that.
No, Bruce, it means that our mores have changed in this country, and we're more likely to buy that kind of nonsense, that more likely to buy a conspiracy theory. I mean, this country has fundamentally changed since the innocent days of Kennedy.
Right.
We don't trust authority. We don't believe authority. We don't believe what we're told by people.
I'm giving you one possible reason why some Americans may not believe the authority figure. It goes back to the authority that this innocent world, the assassination of the president of the United States in Dallas, Texas. You have one of the leading media organizations in the world deciding we're going to protect the American people. We're not going to show them everything. We're going to protect them. Then you have this blue ribbon committee appointed by the president of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, who many people believe may have been involved in the conspiracy. I don't. I want to stress that. I don't think it goes to him, but he appoints this committee. And I've laid out three or four suspect reasons why I, as a young, 21-year-old, 22-year-old, questioned, how do you hire someone who was fired by John Kennedy to look into whether or not somebody assassinated him who might have some connection to the agency, the CIA, that you headed? But why do you appoint a congressman from one of the most corrupt, mob-infested cities in the United States, who obviously had to stay in office for a long time because he made some deals with somebody? How do you appoint him to look into this investigation when some of the evidence led to involvement by organized crime? I mean, how do you appoint a minority leader who doesn't have the time, who doesn't even have time to read the report to put his name on it? I mean,
because commissions are balanced.
Commissions are often put in place not necessarily to find the truth.
Well, that's
they are put in place to validate.
That's why, as a citizen, that's where I would say this is the beginning of where the American people began to say, you know what? There's something that stinks in here. It's rotten in here.
But you said 70% believed it when it came out.
They did, but
30% is a lot.
But what I'm saying is part of that shift to the other 70% is a result of people asking these questions and looking at it at least the way I did. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway. I'm Bruce Dumont. And before we continue, I just want to mention, I've mentioned that next Friday, on the 22nd, we're going to have the NBC coverage of the Kennedy assassination playing throughout the day at the museum, starting at 12:30 in the afternoon. Free admission, no charge at all. And again, 2 days earlier than that, that's this coming Wednesday night, we will also be open free of charge, starting at 5:30, actually starting at 6:30. We are going to talk about the age of innocence. John mentioned that we sort of lived in an age of innocence until the shots rang out in Dallas, Texas. We're going to be playing, we're going to go back 50 years ago to November 20th of 1963, and we're going to play the primetime television coverage. What America was laughing at 2 days before the Kennedy assassination, Ozzie and Harriet, and The Flying Nun, and a whole variety of shows again. So that's coming up Wednesday night. I want to go around the table quickly. I think I know these answers, but I want to clarify. We'll start with Bruno. The assassin, single shooter. Do you believe Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone?
Everything I've seen indicates single shooter, not acting alone.
Marty Gerdy.
I think it was a single shooter, but I don't really care that much.
Single shooter may have had some backstage help.
Yeah, I completely agree with John.
Okay. I believe that Lee Harvey Oswald pulled the trigger. I think he was involved in a patsy in an organization or in a conspiracy that involved elements, renegade elements of the CIA and organized crime. A combination of those factors had to get rid of John Kennedy because he was doing things that they did not like, and he had to go. Let's go to calls. Let's go to Mike listening to us. And obviously, I don't believe the Warren Commission. Mike, go ahead, listening to us in Spokane, Washington.
Bruce, thanks for taking my call. I was a senior in high school at Immaculate Heart of Mary High School in Coeur d'Alene, and my mother called the principal, and the mother superior announced that President Kennedy had been shot. But, you know, President Kennedy brought faith and hope in government, the Peace Corps, the nuclear test ban treaty, and he was trying to bring J. Edgar Hoover under control, the director of the 40 years for the FBI, who actually hated the Kennedys.
I don't know whether he was trying to do that. I think that J. Edgar Hoover was probably trying to bring John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy under control. A little bit more about that. And that's another curious aspect of this is that Lee Harvey Oswald was on the radar of the FBI, specifically J. Edgar Hoover, well in advance of November 22nd of 1963. In fact, the Dallas office the FBI office in Dallas had interviewed Lee Harvey Oswald. So he was on the radar somewhere, just like some of these guys in Boston were on the radar of intelligence there. Let's go to Andy in Boise, Idaho, listening to us on KBOI. You're on the air.
Hello, yes. I just called in to say that back in the late 90s, I read the autobiography of Joey Bananas.
Yes.
And in his book, he claimed that while in prison one time, that someone named John Rosselli or Joseph Rosselli confessed to him as being the second shooter.
I only know the name Johnny Rosselli as a mob operator out of Los Angeles. I don't know that he was ever involved. He might have been involved in some aspect of it, but I never heard anybody was listed as a second shooter in that particular case.
Well, this was in Joseph Bonanno's autobiography, and okay. He had so much information in that book. The feds then used the stuff in the book to put him back in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and also another thing to think about is. When Officer Tippetts was killed, how did the officer know where Oswald was so quickly?
Well, again, that's one of the things that, there have been numerous books written on that about there are those that believe that Officer Tippett may have been involved in some way as part of an attempt to get Oswald before he had to be shot in public. But again, I think the one thing Marty and I would disagree on as to whether it's still important. I think it's still important to know the truth. I don't think there should be a statute of limitation on the truth. I realize that other more important things come up and things do change. But again, I think it would be important, especially since we began this program about talking about a president who, if he didn't out and out lie, he misled voters. We've talked about George W. Bush misleading voters. I mean, I think when people are misled, whether it's by a president or a candidate in a campaign, or they're misled by a presidential commission that's looking for the truth because of a lack of aggressiveness and people really wanting to know the truth, I think it is a disservice to the people. I think it hurts the republic. It hurts if we don't know the truth. So I think the thirst for truth should always be there. There have been literally hundreds of books written. If you want to know about this subject, you don't have to go too far. You certainly don't have to go too far from your televisions or radios or newspapers in the next 7 days when this story will be all over the place. But again, it is a memorable moment. It's a magical moment. It is a very historic moment because, again, the politics of the country changed dramatically. And one of the reasons why they changed dramatically was there was a new leader. And that leader was Lyndon Johnson, who was able to use the legitimate sympathy that the American people felt to move forward legislation that I don't think John Kennedy would have been able to move forward. I think the emotion of that moment is what led to the civil rights movement, the dramatic changes, as well as the escalation of the war, in Southeast Asia, in Vietnam. So a lot did change. We'll never know, obviously, what would have happened had John Kennedy lived. But we do know that, like every leader we've had, there certainly is a darker side of his life. The news media over the last 50 years has changed dramatically. A story that they would not touch 50 years ago is now, you know, common knowledge and common, journalistic MOs in covering campaigns. Now you want to know about the private life of the candidates. Is that important? I happen to think it is, but maybe you do not. But again, it goes back to John F. Kennedy, a remarkable leader of this country, a man who inspired millions of people, who had a great vision, and that vision was snuffed out on November 22nd of 1963. And American politics have not been the same since. And we have discussed that this evening with Bruno Behrend and Marty Garrity and John McCarron and Dave Lundy. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.